Thank you very much for coming. I know that many of you have attended the lectures that were given over the weekend at Beihang University, and some of you also attended the lectures this morning at the Beijing Forestry University. And I know that others of you are coming to these lectures for the first time. So I'm going to start by giving a little background about what this lecture is about. And also relate that to the things I've talked about before that you may not have heard. So this morning I talked about a thing called a semantic map model. This model is used in typology and is starting to be used in some other areas of linguistics, but mainly it's used by people working in the cross-linguistic comparison. The reason this model has become attractive is that the first thing you notice when you start comparing languages, different languages, is that the basic categories are different from one language to the next. And the reason for that, I argued in the lectures this weekend, is that the categories of a language are defined by the constructions that you find in that language. And since the constructions are unique to those languages, you shouldn't expect them to be the same from one language to the next. So typologists have had to deal with this problem for a long time. The semantic map model, which this slide describes here, allows us to represent facts about languages, about universals of conceptual structure, without assuming universal categories. So an old problem in typology is the fact that in addition to languages with a traditional or the Western European style subject and object distinction indicated by these green lines, there are languages with a distinction called ergative and absolutive, where the ergative marker is found only with the transitive subject. That's the A, that's what the A stands for here. And the absolutive marker is found with what we would call an intransitive subject and the transitive object. So many linguists for a long time felt this was a real problem in trying to develop universals of grammar. But it really isn't a problem, because what you can do is come up with a more fine-grained division of semantic roles. That's represented by these letters here. And that more fine-grained division of semantic roles allows us to be able to compare both systems with a nominative accusative pattern and systems with an ergative absolutive pattern. And then the other observation is that if you divide this up into these three different roles, so this is what's traditionally called transitive subject, intransitive subject, transitive object, if you divide up into these more fine-grained categories, then you also make another observation, which is that you don't find a system which groups together, that categorizes or uses the same inflection for both transitive subject and transitive object, and a different inflection for intransitive subject. That's represented by these lines here. The lines show the roles that are possible, it's possible to relate under a single case inflection, and the absence of a line here means you can't connect them there. So this pattern here is called the semantic map model. You come up with more fine-grained categories. These represent the common denominator that you can compare from one language to the next. And then you link them together, and the links represent some kind of degree of conceptual similarity between these roles. So as the second slide here says, we can talk about universal patterns here because the grammatical categories are construction-specific and therefore language-specific. So another point I'd like to make right now, that for those of you who didn't hear the talk this morning, is that the pattern that's in black, these fine-grained categories and the links that link them together, represent a pattern that's universal, whereas the patterns that are in green and red on the slide, those are language-specific grammatical categories. So we can say that for speakers of languages in general, human beings, the semantic roles that you find with intransitive subject category are somehow conceptually intermediate to the roles found with transitive subjects and the roles found with transitive objects. So an important aspect of this, and the one that I'm going to focus on today, is the relationship between what's language universal and what's language specific, particularly with respect to conceptual categories. So here's another example that I'm going to be using quite a bit. This is from research by a German typologist, Martin Hospemat, and it represents an analysis in the same semantic map model of indefinite pronoun meanings. The indefinite pronoun meanings, he identified 9 different indefinite pronoun meanings. Those are the points here. You don't need to worry too much about what those meanings are. I'm just using this example to illustrate. Then there are these links, and the links represent essentially the minimum similarity relations that hold between these different meanings. And then just for illustration, Hasselmatt did a study of 40 languages. Here we have examples of indefinite pronouns from 2 different languages, Romanian and Kazakh. And these things, which we'll call semantic maps, actually outline which uses are found or which meanings are found with each indefinite pronoun in each language. And the important thing to notice here is that any particular indefinite pronoun in any particular language actually is used only for uses that are linked together by these lines. So you can see that this vrei un thing, that's this red thing that goes around like that. So that pronoun form in Romanian is used for these 3 uses, and that's okay because these uses are linked. What you cannot have, just like the ASNP, what you cannot have is an indefinite pronoun that's used both for direct negation and free choice and nothing else because there's no direct link here. If you do have a pronoun that's used for both these functions, then it must include these other functions to follow the links around. So this is the way in which this model limits the possible categories or grammatical categories in this indefinite pronoun domain. But of course, it allows lots and lots of different categories of indefinite pronouns in different languages. So you're not restricted in the category. You're only restricted in this very broad sense. Now, there are a number of conceptual issues that arise with the semantic map model. I've added this slide in response in part to a question I was asked this morning. So in what respect is this conceptual space universal, these meanings that were in black and the links that hold between them? And what sort of conceptual categories are universal? Those of you who have been following the lectures know that this is a topic that Melissa Bowerman has been discussing in several of her lectures. And she talked about this cognitive primacy hypothesis, that there are certain conceptual categories that were universal, available to all speakers and all learners of languages, children learning language, and that these categories were employed by children in learning the grammatical categories of their own language. So Melissa Bowerman gave us a lot of examples showing that this is not going to work as a simple hypothesis. And so we might want to ask, well, can we say that if there is anything that's, what is it about these conceptual categories that might be universal? And then lastly, another important question is, when you see the model of conceptual structure I'm going to present by the conclusion of this lecture, you might be wondering, what's the relationship between form and meaning? That is, what's the grammatical connection between form and meaning in languages based on that model? Well, I'm afraid I won't answer that question today, but if you're able to attend the lectures tomorrow morning, which I believe are at Peking University, then I will talk about that there. Well, it turns out there are also some practical problems for the semantic map model. As I said, it's a good way to analyze what's universal and what's language specific about grammatical categories. It allows grammatical categories to vary from language to language. Unfortunately, it's much harder to apply this model if you use more complicated data and many more languages, many more constructions than just 3 or 4 or 5 or 9. So even though the model looks attractive, it's pretty much impossible to figure it out by hand comparing it larger numbers of languages. Another thing is that there's no standard way to handle exceptions. So when you look at a lot of languages and a lot of data, you can see that some patterns are very widespread and others are are rather anomalous. They're kind of rare, and they may represent something unstable. But the usual way that typologists look at it, which is kind of the linguist's general perspective, is it has to be a perfect fit. So we have to add a link anytime we see two uses connected by a linguistic form in any language. So there's no notion of what the statisticians call goodness of fit. The semantic map model is not mathematically formalized, and from what I've had different opinions given to me by people who are have more mathematical training than I do about this, but it sounds like it may be a very difficult problem to, from a mathematical point of view, to formalize the semantic map model. Another factor which some people have objected to is that the spatial arrangement of these functions is arbitrary. All that matters is how those different uses are linked together. So even though I arranged it in sort of a linear fashion, those indefinite pronoun uses, just like Martin Hausmann did, that linear arrangement doesn't necessarily mean anything. So we'll have to come back to that problem. So there's a solution here, and this is to use a statistical technique which can handle more complex data. This is called multidimensional scaling. And what I'm going to do in this lecture is I'm going to try to explain to you how it works, because I believe that people, you know, most of us, myself included, are not, don't have a, you know, background in mathematics or statistics. The work I've done is in collaboration with others who have that background. And I think that's, you know, the route to go if you aren't in a position to learn about the mathematics yourself. Well, younger people, like younger than me, may have the time to do that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how I perceive this, you know, how you understand how the method works. So it's not like I'm just, you know, waving a magic wand and showing you some facts about languages that are analyzed. And I'm also going to say a little bit about how to use statistics here. I know a lot of you won't do this, but I would hope that from this you'll be able to understand or be able to look at an article that discusses statistics, you know, like the work that this is based on, and have some understanding of why the author did it, you know, analyzed it in this way, and maybe even to question the author if you think he didn't do it in the right way. So what is multidimensional scaling? It's a statistical method of analysis that produces a spatial model. So a model in one, two, or three dimensions or more of similarity relations among data. So we'll see some graphs where you're going to see dots, and the degree of similarity of the dots depends on how close together or how far apart they are in that spatial model. Luckily, it's mathematically well understood and computationally tractable. This method's been developed over a period of over 100 years. Multidimensional scaling is one of a family of techniques, includes factor analysis, principal component analysis, in case you've heard of those. It's a bit different, so the kind of method that you may have heard in Melissa Bauman's earlier talks on correspondence analysis handles the spatial dimensions in a slightly different way. I'm going to avoid dealing with that issue unless someone asks, because I'm sure it's going to be a challenge just to see how this method works by itself. Okay, so you can barely read it there, and you can probably barely read it if you've got a packet because it's such small print, but down there at the bottom it says, this is work I did together with a political scientist named Keith Poole, and we published a paper in a linguistics journal discussing this technique. But he was the statistician who I worked with because he's developed a very powerful algorithm for doing multidimensional scaling. So he's a political scientist, and I'm going to start by showing you how he does it, because I think that will be easier to understand at first than the linguistics. So imagine you want to analyze something like the United States Congress. That's what he works on. And you want to understand the patterns in which various U.S. congressmen vote. So they vote yes or no on various legislative motions, laws, and other things. And of course, they sometimes vote yes, sometimes vote no. They vote differently. There's a long informal description of people in the U.S. Congress as being liberal or conservative. And also, you can talk about them being liberal on social issues but conservative on economic issues, or vice versa. So people talk about this informally. can we actually measure this and talk about just, you know, how are people, the congressmen, similar and different to each other? How do they kind of map out in a spatial model of their political positions? Well, voting behavior is what they call non-parametric. Legislators vote yes or no on legislative motions. Sometimes they're absent, but we can ignore that actually for now. And we also think of legislators like US congressmen as having political stances. It's obvious, we just had an election. People run for office based on their political stance, more liberal, conservative economically or socially or whatever. And we can represent this in a political space. Once they get in office, we can look at what they do instead of what they say. We can look at how they actually vote instead of what they said they were going to do. And from that, you can see just how liberal or conservative they really are, you know, when they are forced to take a stand. So here's what a model would look like. You can see here, I don't have a pointer, I have to use the cursor here. You can see these little Y's and N's. Well, each of these points represents a legislator. The N here represents how this legislator voted on a particular occasion. So he voted no. These ones voted yes. In an ideal world, if this was statistically perfect fit, then you'd have this line here which indicates essentially the political orientation of the legislative motion, and then everybody on one side voted yes, and everyone on the other side voted no. So this line, which is called the cutting line, divides the legislators who voted yes or no on this particular bill. So why are some yeses over here, and this no's up there, and that no's down there, and that no's over there? Why are those people in those spaces? Well, that depends on how they voted on other legislative motions. So what you do is you simultaneously calculate, based on all of the votes that the congressmen make, where they fit in this dimension. And then we could say this dimension is, say, economically liberal and conservative. This dimension is socially liberal or conservative, or whatever. I should add that that's something that the political scientist has to interpret. So the statistical model, all it does is lay out the legislators and tells you how close or far apart they are based on how often they voted together or voted on the opposite side of various laws. And then you have to look at it and say, okay, I see what's going on here. This dimension means economically liberal or conservative, and this dimension means something else. So that has to be the political scientist doing the analysis. The statistics only tells you how legislators are similar or different based on their actual voting behavior. You know, what do we do with language? Well, let me tell you a little story. I met this person, Keith Poole, because we were both on sabbatical at a research institute in Stanford University, and it was interdisciplinary, so people from different subjects. And each of us had to give a little talk about our research to the rest of the people in the group. So when Keith Poole presented basically the same thing I showed you in that last slide, I immediately recognized it as what you see here on this slide. If you see here, this is that same data for Romanian and Kazakh put in a table. I showed you this table this morning. The yeses indicate that this form can be used for these different indefinite pronoun functions. This form can be used for these functions, and so on. So as the bullet point says, you can think of this as these linguistic meanings or functions down the side, so to speak, vote yes or no whether they can be used in that particular linguistic form. Or another way, a more accurate way to think of it is speakers, when they choose to express that meaning, so to speak, vote yes or no by choosing to use a particular form and not another form. So it has to do with how speakers express meaning in form. And once you make this connection, then you see how this works. Now we can use the technique to look at linguistic data. So that's kind of the first thing to think about when you look at statistics. There's lots of different statistical techniques out there, and you have to ask yourself, which is the one that's appropriate to use? And this is a reason why this particular technique is useful for looking at categories, grammatical categories across languages, you know, and their uses. So this is just a summary of that. Functions or meanings are like these political stances of legislators. They're represented by their position in conceptual space. Forms have meanings based on the range of functions they're used for. I'm not going to go into this. But they define the similarity relations among meanings in the conceptual space. So here are those nine indefinite pronoun functions where we have done a multidimensional scaling analysis. I'll say a little bit more about how it happens, but it's essentially the same idea. The positions of these things are based on the whether or not linguistic forms group these functions together or not. So one of these points is a particular situation type, a particular meaning or function of the pronoun. Then you can take a language like Romanian, that was one of the example languages, and then we had those four Romanian indefinite pronoun forms, and you can see the lines divided up. So on this side are the forms you can use with this, are the functions you can use with this form, and the other side are functions you can't use with this form. And then there's a line here for this other form, a line here for that form, a line here for the last form. So those lines together help you position these points, grouping together the ones that have the same form and keeping apart the ones that require a different form. So those lines represent a language-specific indefinite category. And you have to think of it as if the line came all the way across and divided this space into the functions that can be used for the form and the functions that can't be used. So this is what happened to the semantic maps. We had those semantic maps in the old diagrams, which were like squares or kind of funny shapes that group together different things, different uses. Here, a semantic map has to be a straight line that cuts through this. That's because this is a Euclidean geometric spatial model. So the idea is you want to get these cutting lines, these straight lines dividing, describing uses, and arrange all the lines and arrange all the dots representing the uses in such a way that you can always draw a straight line and it will always find a straight line for any language category that will have the uses that the form is found for on one side and the uses it's excluded from on the other side. Now another important point, and this is a statistical point that's often lost on linguists, because linguists aren't used to thinking in this way. A conceptual space, that spatial model with the points that have all the meanings, it's only interesting if it's low dimensional. That's because if you add dimensions, it weakens the constraints on possible cutting lines. If we added a third or a fourth dimension, then basically every use could be similar to every other use on some dimension. Well, that's not terribly helpful. It doesn't really constrain the possibilities much. Now, it's possible that there is no pattern. You know, languages really can just group meanings together in any old way. The reality is, at least for the cases that I've investigated, that that's not true. There's always some kind of limitation that shows that there's some structure to our conceptual space, to the relationships between concepts. Okay, I mentioned before we have to have goodness of fit. You know, no statistical model is perfect. It's only an approximation to help you understand complex data that you can't analyze by hand. So the way this works in statistics is you have to have some kind of measurement of how good the fit is. Now, in multidimensional scaling in particular, you try to model all this cross-linguistic variation in different dimensions. So you try to force the model to be just one-dimensional, just a line. Or two-dimensional, that's what I showed you before, or you could have a three-dimensional model as well. And then what you do is you ask yourself, how well does the one-dimensional model fit the data? How well does the two-dimensional model fit the data? How well does the three-dimensional model fit the data? And you have to have some way to measure that. The statistics that my colleague Keith Poole uses, one is correct classification, so how well does the data correctly divide up the uses that are found on one side and the uses that are excluded on the other side. And this is another measure I won't go into for now. It's another way of measuring essentially how good the model is. I can talk about it later if people want. Okay, the fitness statistics indicate a two-dimensional model is best. And this is where you're probably thinking, what? What about a three-dimensional model? It's perfect, 100% correct classification. Well, as I said, this is where statisticians and linguists tend to think differently. If you add a third dimension, as I said, that makes the model weaker. There's too many different ways that meanings could be similar. So you want a stronger model. So even a model that's not perfect might be better than a model that is perfect. After all, if you add enough dimensions, you'll eventually get a perfect model. So what really matters is you have to compare these numbers and see if adding another dimension really makes the model fit better. Now, going from 90.8 to 98.1 is a big jump in fitness. Going from 98 to 100, even though it makes the model perfect, is not a whole, you're not gaining a whole lot by adding a third dimension. And the same with this measure here, from 0.685 to 0.93 is a big jump. 93 to 1.00, even though that's perfect, is not a big jump. So again, adding a third dimension, it just only improves your model a little bit, and it makes the model a lot weaker. So we'll stick to two dimensions. Okay, now I want to compare this model. The next thing to think about with a statistical model is it's always a good idea to check it against some data where you kind of know where the answer is already, to make sure that you're actually getting a sensible result. In this case, we have a study that Hostelmott did by hand, and we can compare what he discovered with what this statistical model will show us. So this is what he discovered. As I said before, in the traditional semantic map model, what matters are these links. Nevertheless, this slide is not on your handout. There's a few slides not on your handout because I made some changes for those of you who had handouts. Hopefully changes that will make it more comprehensible. So the links are what matters, and you can see that it's roughly linear. I mean, it's kind of a complex thing on the right-hand side, but it looks almost like almost could be a one-dimensional model. Not good enough to be a true one-dimensional model. Okay, so let's take that semantic map. It's a spatial model represented by the locations of these dots. And now let's put in the links that were in the semantic map model. So as you can see, it looks pretty good. Distance in this spatial model corresponds pretty well to distance links on the model, except that this conceptual space is sort of curved in a horseshoe shape. So that's one problem we want to look at, is why is it different from what Hostelmott did? The other thing is that if distance really mattered, this dot here representing indirect negation ought to be a little further out, because it looks too close to conditional, and there's no link in the semantic map model. So the whole model would look better if this was out a little further. So I'm going to address both these questions here and illustrate some things about the semantic map, about multidimensional scaling with this. Okay, so let's look at this diagram. This shows you some of the lines that represent indefinite pronoun categories in specific languages. So remember I said the cutting lines have to be straight. So the semantic maps are straight lines cutting the space in half. However, some cutting lines cut in the middle of this sort of hierarchy. I'll illustrate this with a simpler example in a moment. Since the straight cutting lines in the middle mean that the space must be curved. You probably don't understand that. I'm going to show you with a simpler example with some additional slides I made last night. Okay, so let's consider something that really is a simple hierarchy. This is an example I used this morning. It has to do with how different languages use the plural inflection. Languages vary as to which pronoun and noun categories allow a plural inflection. So English allows anything. Mandarin Chinese actually is quite limited in when you use the plural inflection. So if we compare different languages, we can see that on the whole there's a nice scale. that shows you the semantic map. So this is a semantic map model. The different categories are linked by the lines, the black lines here, and then these boxes represent the semantic maps, because you can draw boxes with semantic maps. If you want to translate this to a multidimensional scaling model, I don't even have to bother to plot it. It's very simple. You have a one-dimensional model here, and then you have these cutting lines. And the reason for that is that all of these plural categories include every category of semantic category of noun and pronoun to the left. So if you have a cutting line here, it includes everything to the left. Cutting line here, everything to the left. So a nice linear arrangement works fine. Now I'll give you another kind of example. This is what's called the grammatical relations hierarchy, or the noun phrase accessibility hierarchy. It was first discovered by the typologists Bernard Comrie and Edward Keenan back in the 1970s. And their claim was, if you look at relative clause constructions in different languages and ask you which grammatical relation can you form the relative clause on, the following generalization holds. So here's some made-up examples, but hypothetical examples. So here's the generalization. A relative clause construction covers a continuous segment of the accessibility hierarchy. So this blue box goes all the way to the left, the brown box goes all the way to the right, but the red box includes the two in the grammatical relations in the middle, and the little orange box includes just the indirect object relation that's also in the middle. If you want to convert this to a multidimensional scaling model, the cutting lines have to be straight. So the only way you can do this is to have our grammatical relations hierarchy a little curved. Then you can put a cutting line in here, a straight cutting line that includes only the indirect object, and a straight cutting line that includes only the direct object and the indirect object. So that's why the conceptual space, the spatial model for the indefinite pronouns is curved. It's because there are some indefinite pronoun categories that include only uses in the middle of that roughly linear arrangement. Now, if we compare multidimensional scaling and semantic maps, this is every cutting line, so all of the data from the 40 languages that Hausmann looked at. If you want to, as I said, you have to put every concept in a position so that the cutting lines will be right. So something like this dot, this usage here, is extremely constrained. It can only occur right in here. This one can occur only right in here. This dot could have occurred anywhere in this general region. This one's very limited. Let me see, I think I have another. Yeah, so this one, the computer program that constructs these spatial models, it has to put the dot somewhere inside this shape, which Keith Poole calls a polytope. It's limited by that. Sometimes it's really constrained, other times there's a little bit of room. This dot could have been down here. So then we have the indirect negation. Well, you can see its position is not very constrained. It could be way down here. And remember, that was the dot that was a little too close to the other ones, I said, compared to the semantic map model. Well, the reason that the spatial model, the multidimensional scaling computer program, put it there is because it could have put it further out, but the algorithm kind of just sticks it as close in as possible. So this thing could actually be out here somewhere. That's probably a more accurate description. So this is a reminder that statistical models are only approximate, but they can be very useful because they can analyze much more complicated and messy data than we usually can analyze by hand. And that's very important because the linguistic point I want to make at the end of this talk, you can only really see it and appreciate it if you look at really complex data sets. If you look at simple data sets, it's not so obvious, or it would be less difficult, less easy for me to persuade you about this point. I'm going to show you briefly another example. This is actually the most difficult data that we analyzed, and it shows a different kind of spatial model. Another typologist, Östen Dahl, in a groundbreaking work from 25 years ago, developed a questionnaire to look at tense aspect categories or constructions across the world's languages. He ended up getting data on 200 different contexts, 200 different sentences with different tense aspect meanings in, I think, 65 languages. He got his colleagues who were either native speakers or field workers on particular languages to give him the data. Yeah, 200 distinct contexts, 65 languages. So here's an example. The setup question is, when you came to this place a year ago, did you know my brother? And the response is no. And then they put, he didn't want to inflect it in English to give away what the English tense aspect construction is. So he just put it in capital letters, the verb, and then asked native speakers in the questionnaire to provide the sentence with the tense aspect construction that you would find for that context, where the context is explained here. Thank you very much for coming. I know that many of you have attended the lectures that were given over the weekend at Beihang University, and some of you also attended the lectures this morning at the Beijing Forestry University. And I know that others of you are coming to these lectures for the first time. So I'm going to start by giving a little background about what this lecture is about, and also relate that to the things I've talked about before that you may not have heard. So this morning I talked about a thing called a semantic map model. This model is used in typology and is starting to be used in some other areas of linguistics, but mainly it's used by people working in the cross-linguistic comparison. The reason this model has become attractive is that the first thing you notice when you start comparing languages, different languages, is that the basic categories are different from one language to the next. And the reason for that, I argued in the lectures this weekend, is that the categories of a language are defined by the constructions that you find in that language. And since the constructions are unique to those languages, you shouldn't expect them to be the same from one language to the next. So typologists have had to deal with this problem for a long time. Oops, back. The semantic map model, which this slide describes here, allows us to represent facts about languages, about universals of conceptual structure, without assuming universal categories. So an old problem in typology is the fact that in addition to languages with a traditional or the Western European style subject and object distinction indicated by these green lines, there are languages with a distinction called ergative and absolutive, where the ergative marker is found only with the transitive subject, that's the A, that's what the A stands for here, and the absolutive marker is found with what we would call an intransitive subject and the transitive object. So many linguists for a long time felt this was a real problem in trying to develop universals of grammar. But it really isn't a problem, because what you can do is come up with a more fine-grained division of semantic roles. That's represented by these letters here. And that more fine-grained division of semantic roles allows us to be able to compare both systems with a nominative accusative pattern and systems with an ergative absolutive pattern. And then the other observation is that if you divide this up into these three different roles, so this is what's traditionally called transitive subject, intransitive subject, transitive object, if you divide up into these more fine-grained categories, then you also make another observation, which is that you don't find a system which groups together, that categorizes or uses the same inflection for both transitive subject and transitive object, and a different inflection for intransitive subject. That's represented by these lines here. The lines show the roles that are possible, it's possible to relate under a single case inflection, and the absence of a line here means you can't connect them there. So this pattern here is called the semantic map model. You come up with more fine-grained categories. These represent the common denominator that you can compare from one language to the next. And then you link them together, and the links represent some kind of degree of conceptual similarity between these roles. So as the second slide here says, we can talk about universal patterns here because the grammatical categories are construction specific and therefore language specific. So another point I'd like to make right now that for those of you who didn't hear the talk this morning is that the pattern that's in black, these fine-grained categories and the links that link them together, represent a pattern that's universal, whereas the patterns that are in green and red on the slide, those are language-specific grammatical categories. So we can say that for speakers of languages in general, human beings, the semantic roles that you find with intransitive subject category are somehow conceptually intermediate to the roles found with transitive subjects and the roles found with transitive objects. So an important aspect of this, and the one that I'm going to focus on today, is the relationship between what's language universal and what's language specific, particularly with respect to conceptual categories. So here's another example that I'm going to be using quite a bit. This is from research by a German typologist, Martin Hospemat, and it represents an analysis in the same semantic map model of indefinite pronoun meanings. The indefinite pronoun meanings, he identified 9 different indefinite pronoun meanings. Those are the points here. You don't need to worry too much about what those meanings are. I'm just using this example to illustrate. Then there are these links, and the links represent essentially the minimum similarity relations that hold between these different meanings. And then just for illustration, Hasselmatt did a study of 40 languages. Here we have examples of indefinite pronouns from 2 different languages, Romanian and Kazakh. And these things, which we'll call semantic maps, actually outline which uses are found or which meanings are found with each indefinite pronoun in each language. And the important thing to notice here is that any particular indefinite pronoun in any particular language actually is used only for uses that are linked together by these lines. So you can see that this vrei un thing, that's this red thing that goes around like that, so that pronoun form in Romanian is used for these 3 uses, and that's okay because these uses are linked. What you cannot have, just like the ASNP, what you cannot have is an indefinite pronoun that's used both for direct negation and free choice and nothing else because there's no direct link here. If you do have a pronoun that's used for both these functions, then it must include these other functions to follow the links around. So this is the way in which this model limits the possible categories that are grammatical categories in this indefinite pronoun domain. But of course, it allows lots and lots of different categories of indefinite pronouns in different languages. So you're not restricted in the category. You're only restricted in this very broad sense. Now, there are a number of conceptual issues that arise with the semantic map model. I've added this slide in response in part to a question I was asked this morning. So in what respect is this conceptual space universal, these meanings that were in black and the links that hold between them? And what sort of conceptual categories are universal? Those of you who have been following the lectures know that this is a topic that Melissa Bowerman has been discussing in several of her lectures. And she talked about this cognitive primacy hypothesis, that there are certain conceptual categories that were universal, available to all speakers and all learners of languages, children learning language, and that these categories were employed by children in learning the grammatical categories of their own language. So Melissa Bowerman gave us a lot of examples showing that this is not going to work as a simple hypothesis. And so we might want to ask, well, can we say that if there is anything that's, what is it about these conceptual categories that might be universal? And then lastly, another important question is, when you see the model of conceptual structure I'm going to present by the conclusion of this lecture, you might be wondering, what's the relationship between form and meaning? That is, what's the grammatical connection between form and meaning in languages based on that model? Well, I'm afraid I won't answer that question today, but if you're able to attend the lectures tomorrow morning, which I believe are at Peking University, then I will talk about that there. Well, it turns out there are also some practical problems for the semantic map model. As I said, it's a good way to analyze what's universal and what's language specific about grammatical categories. It allows grammatical categories to vary from language to language. Unfortunately, it's much harder to apply this model if you use more complicated data and many more languages, many more constructions than just 3 or 4 or 5 or 9. So even though the model looks attractive, it's pretty much impossible to figure it out by hand comparing it larger numbers of languages. Another thing is that there's no standard way to handle exceptions. So when you look at a lot of languages and a lot of data, you can see that some patterns are very widespread and others are rather anomalous. They're kind of rare and they may represent something unstable. But the usual way that typologists look at it, which is kind of the linguist's general perspective, is it has to be a perfect fit. So we have to add a link anytime we see two uses connected by a linguistic form in any language. So there's no notion of what the statisticians call goodness of fit. The semantic map model is not mathematically formalized, and from what I've had different opinions given to me by people who are have more mathematical training than I do about this, but it sounds like it may be a very difficult problem to from a mathematical point of view, to formalize the semantic map model. Another factor which some people have objected to is that the spatial arrangement of these functions is arbitrary. All that matters is how those different uses are linked together. So even though I arranged it in sort of a linear fashion, those indefinite pronoun uses, just like Martin Hausmann did, that linear arrangement doesn't necessarily mean anything. So we'll have to come back to that problem. So there's a solution here, and this is to use a statistical technique which can handle more complex data. This is called multidimensional scaling. And what I'm going to do in this lecture is I'm going to try to explain to you how it works, because I believe that people, you know, most of us, myself included, don't have a background in mathematics or statistics. The work I've done is in collaboration with others who have that background. And I think that's, you know, the route to go if you aren't in a position to learn about the mathematics yourself. Well, younger people, like younger than me, may have the time to do that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how I perceive this, you know, how you understand how the method works. So it's not like I'm just, you know, waving a magic wand and showing you some facts about languages that are analyzed. And I'm also going to say a little bit about how to use statistics here. I know a lot of you won't do this, but I would hope that from this you'll be able to understand or be able to look at an article that discusses statistics, you know, like the work that this is based on, and have some understanding of why the author did it, you know, analyze it in this way, and maybe even to question the author if you think he didn't do it in the right way. So what is multidimensional scaling? It's a statistical method of analysis that produces a spatial model. So a model in 1, 2, or 3 dimensions or more of similarity relations among data. So we'll see some graphs where you're going to see dots, and the degree of similarity of the dots depends on how close together or how far apart they are in that spatial model. Luckily, it's mathematically well understood and computationally tractable. This method's been developed over a period of over 100 years. Multidimensional scaling is one of a family of techniques, includes factor analysis, principal component analysis, in case you've heard of those. It's a bit different, so the kind of method that you may have heard in Melissa Bauman's earlier talks on correspondence analysis handles the spatial dimensions in a slightly different way. I'm going to avoid dealing with that issue unless someone asks, because I'm sure it's going to be a challenge just to see how this method works by itself. Okay, so you can barely read it there, and you can probably barely read it if you've got a packet because it's such small print, but the down there at the bottom it says, this is work I did together with a political scientist named Keith Poole, and we published a paper in a linguistics journal discussing this technique. But he was the statistician who I worked with because he's developed a very powerful algorithm for doing multidimensional scaling. So he's a political scientist, and I'm going to start by showing you how he does it, because I think that will be easier to understand at first than the linguistics. So imagine you want to analyze something like the United States Congress. That's what he works on. And you want to understand the patterns in which various U.S. congressmen vote. So they vote yes or no on various legislative motions, laws, and other things. And of course, they sometimes vote yes, sometimes vote no. They vote differently. There's a long informal description of people in the U.S. Congress as being liberal or conservative. And also, you can talk about them being liberal on social issues but conservative on economic issues, or vice versa. So you can talk, people talk about this informally. Can we actually measure this and talk about just, you know, how are people, the congressmen, similar and different to each other? How do they kind of map out in a spatial model of their political positions? Well, voting behavior is what they call non-parametric. Legislators vote yes or no on legislative motions. Sometimes they're absent, but we can ignore that actually for now. And we also think of legislators like U.S. congressmen as having political stances. It's obvious, we just had an election. People run for office based on their political stance, more liberal, conservative economically or socially or whatever. And we can represent this in a political space. Once they get in office, we can look at what they do instead of what they say. We can look at how they actually vote instead of what they said they were going to do. And from that, you can see just how liberal or conservative they really are, you know, when they are forced to take a stand. So here's what a model would look like. You can see here, I don't have a pointer, I have to use the cursor here. You can see these little Y's and N's. Well, each of these points represents a legislator. The N here represents how this legislator voted on a particular occasion. So he voted no. These ones voted yes. In an ideal world, if this was statistically perfect fit, then you'd have this line here which indicates essentially the political orientation of the legislative motion, and then everybody on one side voted yes, and everyone on the other side voted no. So this line, which is called a cutting line, divides the legislators who voted yes or no on this particular bill. So why are some yeses over here, and this no's up there, and that no's down there, and that no's over there? Why are those people in those spaces? Well, that depends on how they voted on other legislative motions. So what you do is you simultaneously calculate, based on all of the votes that the congressmen make, where they fit in this dimension. And then we could say this dimension is, say, economically liberal and conservative. This dimension is socially liberal or conservative, or whatever. I should add that that's something that the political scientist has to interpret. So the statistical model, all it does is lay out the legislators and tells you how close or far apart they are based on how often they voted together or voted on the opposite side of various laws. And then you have to look at it and say, okay, I see what's going on here. This dimension means economically liberal or conservative, and this dimension means something else. So that has to be the political scientist doing the analysis. The statistics only tells you how legislators are similar or different based on their actual voting behavior. Okay, now what do we do with language? Well, let me tell you a little story. I met this person, Keith Poole, because we were both on sabbatical at a research institute in Stanford University, and it was interdisciplinary, so people from different subjects. And each of us had to give a little talk about our research, to the rest of the people in the group. So when Keith Poole presented basically the same thing I showed you in that last slide, I immediately recognized it as what you see here on this slide. If you see here, this is that same data for Romanian and Kazakh put in a table. I showed you this table this morning. The yeses indicate that this form can be used for these different indefinite pronoun functions. This form can be used for these functions, and so on. So as the bullet point says, you can think of this as these linguistic meanings or functions down the side, so to speak, vote yes or no whether they can be used in that particular linguistic form. Or another way, a more accurate way to think of it is speakers, when they choose to express that meaning, so to speak, vote yes or no by choosing to use a particular form and not another form. So it has to do with how speakers express meaning in form. And once you make this connection, then you see how this works. Now we can use the technique to look at linguistic data. So that's kind of the first thing to think about when you look at statistics. There's lots of different statistical techniques out there, and you have to ask yourself, which is the one that's appropriate to use? And this is the reason why this particular technique is useful for looking at categories, grammatical categories across languages, and their uses. So this is just a summary of that. Functions or meanings are like these political stances of legislators. They're represented by their position in conceptual space. Forms have meanings based on the range of functions they're used for. I'm not going to go into this. But they define the similarity relations among meanings in the conceptual space. So here are those 9 indefinite pronoun functions where we have done a multidimensional scaling analysis. I'll say a little bit more about how it happens. But it's essentially the same idea. The positions of these things are based on the whether or not linguistic forms group these functions together or not. So one of these points is a particular situation type, a particular meaning or function of the pronoun. Then you can take a language like Romanian, that was one of the example languages, and then we had those 4 Romanian indefinite pronoun forms, and you can see the lines divided up. So on this side are the forms you can use with this, or the functions you can use with this form, and the other side are functions you can't use with this form. And then there's a line here for this other form, a line here for that form, a line here for the last form. So those lines together help you position these points, grouping together the ones that have the same form and keeping apart the ones that require a different form. So those lines represent a language-specific indefinite category. And you have to think of it as if the line came all the way across and divided this space into the functions that can be used for the form and the functions that can't be used. So this is what happened to those semantic maps. We had those semantic maps in the old diagrams, which were like squares or kind of funny shapes that group together different things, different uses. Here, a semantic map has to be a straight line that cuts through this. That's because this is a Euclidean geometric spatial model. So the idea is you want to get these cutting lines, these straight lines describing uses, and arrange all the lines and arrange all the dots representing the uses in such a way that you can always draw a straight line, and it will always find a straight line for any language category that will have the uses that the form is found for on one side and the uses it's excluded from on the other side. Now, another important point, and this is a statistical point that's often lost on linguists, because linguists aren't used to thinking in this way. The conceptual space, that spatial model with the points that have all the meanings, it's only interesting if it's low dimensional. That's because if you add dimensions, it weakens the constraints on possible cutting lines. If we added a third or a fourth dimension, then basically every use could be similar to every other use on some dimension. Well, that's not terribly helpful. It doesn't really constrain the possibilities much. Now, it's possible that there is no pattern. You know, languages really can't just group meanings together in any old way. The reality is, at least for the cases that I've investigated, that that's not true. There's always some kind of limitation that shows that there's some structure to our conceptual space, to the relationships between concepts. Okay, I mentioned before we have to have goodness of fit. You know, no statistical model is perfect. It's only an approximation to help you understand complex data that you can't analyze by hand. So the way this works in statistics is you have to have some kind of measurement of how good the fit is. Now, in multidimensional scaling in particular, you try to model all this cross-linguistic variation in different dimensions. So you try to force the model to be just one-dimensional, just a line, or two-dimensional, that's what I showed you before, or you could have a three-dimensional model as well. And then what you do is you ask yourself, how well does the one-dimensional model fit the data? How well does the two-dimensional model fit the data? How well does the three-dimensional model fit the data? And you have to have some way to measure that. The statistics that my colleague Keith Poole uses, one is correct classification. So how well does the data correctly, you know, divide up the uses that are found on one side and the uses that are excluded on the other side? And this is another measure I won't go into for now. It's another way of measuring essentially how good the model is. I can talk about it later if people want. Okay, the fitness statistics indicate a two-dimensional model is best. And this is where you're probably thinking, what? What about a three-dimensional model? It's perfect, 100% for correct classification. Well, as I said, this is where statisticians and linguists tend to think differently. If you add a third dimension, as I said, that makes the model weaker. There's too many different ways that meanings could be similar. So you want a stronger model. So even a model that's not perfect might be better than a model that is perfect. After all, if you add enough dimensions, you'll eventually get a perfect model. So what really matters is you have to compare these numbers and see if adding another dimension really makes the model fit better. Now, going from 90.8 to 98.1 is a big jump in fitness. Going from 98 to 100, even though it makes the model perfect, is not a whole, you're not gaining